Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In short order in August, the top two leaders at the Ohio Department of Education announced their departures. Paolo DiMaria, the superintendent of public instruction, retired in September. Deputy Superintendent John Richard left in October. President of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, Melissa Cropper, in an August interview with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, praised both Richard and DiMaria. She said she hoped the next leader would continue to keep politics out of education policy.
Being superintendent of public education in Ohio is a very important position and is not one that should be controlled by political ideology. It is a position where a person needs to be in touch with those people who are doing this work on a day-to-day basis. So yes, we're always concerned when this position opens up.
That may be easier said than done in this age of hyperpartisanship. Paolo DiMaria served nearly 6 years as state superintendent. In January, he takes over as president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. Welcome, Paolo DiMaria.
Ann Fisher, it's fantastic to be with you.
Wow. We were just talking before we went on the air about how long we've known each other.
It goes
back to the late 80s, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it was when the first lawsuit for school funding came across. It was probably in 1991,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
And you were involved in that whole thing.
Right, right. So in the late 80s, I started my career working in the legislature for 6 years, ended up working for the state Senate for the Republican caucus,
yeah.
And then made the transition to the state budget office at that time under Greg Browning. And I think that's probably when, you know, I might have, our paths might have crossed.
Well, because
more,
after
more
every budget release, I would call up, it would be 50 questions
that's
every
right,
day.
That's right.
That's one way to get to know somebody.
Well, and when I think back, you know, so many great reporters. I mean, this is just a real tribute to the importance of media and their coverage of statehouse activities. So many great reporters, great writers who had their own expertise and, you know, continue to be an important part of the process.
You never had a problem with that. Neither did Greg Browning.
Yeah, well, you know, the part is I'm always going to be up front. And I think reporters like yourself and the many others always appreciated that. They knew they could get a straight answer. I wasn't going to try to mislead anybody. And I also try to, you know, translate complicated technical information into something that's able to be accessed by people.
Which is what I needed so badly.
Which is we all do that all the time. And I think, you know, it's an important part of working in government.
Why did you retire now?
Well, you know, what happens is you get that letter from the state retirement system saying, hey, you're eligible to retire without reduced benefits, right? And you think, you know, it's a moment where you sort of, well, you know, what should I do? Is that the right thing to do? And so what do? You start reflecting on your own career, your own history, where you are, you know, what's unfinished. And we were just coming off of a couple of things that had happened middle of this year, a new funding system. You know, we've all been longing for a funding system that could represent that sort of, you know, step forward in the DeRolf scenario, and that was enacted as part of the budget. And we also had some significant reform on the state report card system. So if you look at some of the major pieces of public policy and education system, those two, along with others that had been, you know, happened in previous years, you know, kind of rounded out some of the big issue areas. And so, you know, and then as I reflected on the things that I had hoped to accomplish over my career state superintendent, I said, you know, there's a lot of good that's happened, and maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to move on to the next chapter and let the, you know, the seeds and the fertilizer that have been planted, you know, grow, and lots of great people carrying on the work and moving the state forward. So, you know, it was like, okay, let's go find what the next chapter is going to look like.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and pardon me, my guest this hour is Paolo DiMaria. He is the latest newly retired Ohio superintendent of public instruction. He held that position for nearly 6 years until his retirement in September. And in January, he becomes president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. Coming up later in the program, if you have a question or comment for Paolo DiMaria, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The second in charge, Deputy Superintendent John Richard, decided to retire as well. Any you know, coordination there? I mean,
no,
are you
really
disappointed?
I think John's situation was, he just, you know, and this has happened to all of us from one
same
time
diff,
or another.
Yeah.
Something comes up that's just, you just can't say no to. It's just a very attractive offer at a very opportune time. He's from the Stark County area, and it was just something too good to say no to. So I don't think there's anything more to read into it than that.
Stephanie K. Siddons has assumed the role of acting superintendent.
Yep.
She assumed that role on September 25th. A national search is underway, or it's getting underway, to replace you. What's your sense about what they should be looking for a state superintendent of public instruction?
Well, first and foremost, I think there are going to be plenty of people who are going to be interested in the job. Ohio's a great state. It's got a great reputation. A lot of, you know, a big state is very attractive to the people that see themselves as leading major state education agencies. So, you know, I think, you know, as I reflect on what I found to be very helpful, is somebody who's a consensus builder, who's a good listener, who brings people together. Because I think all those things ultimately is what leads to the kind of consensus that you need to effectively manage and govern, the education system of the state. I think there are plenty of people that are out there that have those qualifications and are ready to serve the state of Ohio.
You know, there's a distinction that's kind of sunk in for me over the years now, finally, in a way, is that the state superintendent, the real connection you have out there is with the people who teach. It's not with the consumers, it's with the providers.
Right.
And it's an important distinction.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, I mean, the way I always describe it is we operate in a strange ecosystem, right? People will say, well, Paulo, you are appointed by the state board, right? So your primary responsibility is to the state board. But you can't really be effective if you don't also have good relations with the legislature or with the governor's office or with the major associations or with the unions. And in some ways, you also have the general citizenry and the taxpayers who you have an obligation and you're accountable to. So part of what I think makes any superintendent successful is how do you manage that operating in that climate, so that what you're doing, again, is the most successful experience is when you bring people together and everybody's on the same page and says, yeah, this feels good. This is the right thing for us to do. And we're all going to join hands and do it together.
You were appointed unanimously by the state school board, excuse me, almost 6 years ago. Do you think that would happen today?
I think it can happen. I think it can. The people that appointed me were Republicans and Democrats,
right,
conservatives, liberals, business people and former teachers, practitioners. So I wouldn't rule it out.
But a lot's changed in 6 years.
Well, there are things that are different, but I think you could look back 6 years ago and still find that there may be people with, you know, varying and differences of opinion on any number of education policy issues, whether it's, you know, choice or funding or the role of teachers or what have you. And yet you can still coalesce around a leader that you know is going to be respectful of those different points of view and ultimately, do a couple of things. One is effectively manage a large bureaucracy, which I think a lot of times people forget that's, you know, a key role and in many ways an important role is, you know, just keeping the trains running on time and doing the work. But then also someone who's going to try to understand where everybody's coming from and find that path that allows the state to move forward on its, you know, trajectory to excellence.
What's the relationship between the state board of the state department of education and local school districts? What's that relationship?
Well, in many respects, it's a support function, right?
Okay.
I mean, we're one of the things I set out to do early on was to say, hey, look, you know, the department does a really good job in terms of compliance, but we need to be more supportive and more service oriented. And so we managed to accomplish a little bit of that over the years, primarily through the strategic plan and a number of things that evolved from that. But also my personal commitment to just building stronger partnerships, really talking to the major associations, talking to teachers, talking to administrators, talking to those who had interest and stake in the education system, and listening, and then, you know, sort of bringing people together to create, you know, consensus around what are the right things that we can be doing to actually allow us to become more and more successful. So I think your point, you know, your point is well made. But I don't. In some ways, we are servant to the districts. Our job is to help create the conditions where they can be successful. And I think that's how I have viewed it.
What is your sense about, you know, we're devoting a whole hour tomorrow to the nationalization of issues at this hyper-local level of school board. Twice as many people are running for it as they did the last round. It's certainly the case, you know, in my town, which I think is also your town. It's very divisive. It's gotten very ugly. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that? It mostly revolves around how we teach history. And how we, and whether or not people are masked in the schools.
Yeah. And I think that's the interesting part. You've got these two sort of very niche issues, right? If you think about those two and what that represents in a student's totality of their education experience over a year, right? It's a very small piece. But those are issues that people are very emotional about. And I think what you see happen is that when people, in fact, are very emotional about those things, it does sometimes trigger their interest in saying, okay, well, I'm gonna run for, you know, and this is the way our democracy is set up. You sometimes you run because you have a vested interest in the general benefit of the school system, and sometimes you run because you've got a niche issue that you really feel strongly about. And then you discover that there's a lot more to it than that particular issue, and you have to wrestle with those issues as well. So, I mean, I think you'll see from time to time those kinds of things happen either at a very micro level in a particular community when some one thing happens that gets a bunch of people riled up, or like what's happening now is where you've got a couple of relatively modest issues that a lot of people are interested in, a lot of people have emotional responses to, and that's creating more of a wave of interest in, you know, this governing entity called the local school board.
And having that kind of issue trickle down to the local school board, is that a healthy thing to be debating, say, how we teach history in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's important to let the local community make decisions, and that local citizens elected to local office be involved in those, which I think is juxtaposed against either the federal government or the state government saying you must do this or you can't do that. Right. So it's while some of the issues and the perspectives on those issues are being localized, in some ways, recognizing that it's a local decision to be made, including who gets elected to the school board, I think is what feels good to me about it, because ultimately that's what I say in so many issues in education is, look, the decision about how history is taught in the classroom, that should be made by the local, you know, and in fact, in state law, it says the local board gets to decide what the curriculum is. I had to say so many times to people, the state board doesn't decide curriculum. The state board might set standards, but what's actually taught in the classroom is properly vested in with the local school board, reflecting the, you know, the interests of the community. And so that local control idea, we all hear it, right? And we all talk about it. But there are places where, in fact, it is important and has value, which is why, you know, we have this great, wonderful sort of, you know, no one size fits all system of education. And that's OK. That's a real asset.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Paolo Di Maria. He is just retired in September as Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction. He held that position for nearly 6 years until his retirement in September. In January, he becomes president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. If you have a question or comment for Paolo Di Maria, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Still with us is Paolo Di Maria. He retired in September as the state superintendent of public instruction, a position he held for nearly 6 years. In January, he heads to the National Association of State Boards of Education as its president and CEO. He's with us for the hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The State Board of Education made news recently when it rescinded its anti-racism resolution in favor of one condemning any teachings that seek to divide. And as an educator, how do you put a statement like that into practice? What are your thoughts about that when you're rolling out something like that?
Well, I think, you know, the reality is there's still a strong sense of the need for equity and you know, opposing racism. I think that message still comes out in the revisions that were made to the resolution. And at the same time, I also think this goes back to a discussion about, you know, where decision making is best made. Right. And state law in Ohio is pretty clear that ultimately the choices around curriculum rest with local school boards. And that's really important. And so I think local school boards are the places where decisions need to be made in the context of that particular community and the community values and, you know, the perspectives that reflect the different points of view on these particular issues. So, you know, I'm always, you know, when people talk about issues that are divisive, I think, well, you know, there are a lot of, you know, are you a Browns fan or a Steelers fan, right? I mean, you can be divisive on many, many different subjects. The point is helping people make sure they understand the different points of view and that those different points of view have validity and legitimacy. And we as a nation and as communities have to struggle to reconcile those realities and continue to work forward to a better day.
Well, do you think people are prepared to bring up the and take on these topics in a thorough, illuminating, non-angry way?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think they are, because I think we've seen, you know, since George Floyd and those other instances that really triggered kind of this renewed national awareness about social justice and issues of racism, that people are hungry for more information and better information. And what fascinates me and what really encourages me is that a lot of it's students, young people, mm-hmm. young people who have more friends that are diverse, young people that have, you know, have relatives who are more diverse. And that they're, you know, when you saw the, you know, some of the protests, who were the marchers? They weren't always all, you know, minority. They were from diverse backgrounds, you know, and many young people who understand with great clarity some of the realities that are faced by minority populations in this country and understand the unfairness of it and are hungry for better information that helps their understanding and then understanding what they can do to make a difference.
Local school board races have also become ground zero for clashes over pandemic-related issues, rules for vaccines and masks. All parents say they value education, but how to unify around this idea of these different interpretations of what makes up a good education? What are your thoughts about that? And at the local level, because pandemic is, by definition, worldwide.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those interesting things where again, I'll come back to the student voice. I mean, I talk to many students and, you know, students are always brutally honest. And the ones I, you know, would always say, look, if wearing a mask means I can go back to school and be with my friends and do the things that I want to do in a semi-normal setting, then I'm willing to do it. I mean, it was a very pragmatic, very insightful kind of point of view. And I think a lot of times when we see these school board meetings, you know, the voice of the students is either not listen, you know, not present at all, or it's being ignored. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when that's the case, because, you know, at the end of the day, when you think about it, you're really not asking for a tremendous sacrifice or a tremendous imposition in terms of what, you know, what is something that we do for the greater good. So but that said, I think communities are, you know, can work through these things and we'll see ourselves move past it to a better place.
And so, you know, on that score, the theme of the local is better approach, Republicans in the Ohio House have introduced two bills that would ban the teaching of what they're calling divisive concepts, whatever that means, how to teach history when lawmakers, you know, and I'm wondering about that, if they start to, which they've been want to do over the last 10 years, erode local control on lots of different levels. How do you feel about doing that and making curriculum decisions at the state level in that way?
Well, I continue to be an advocate for local determination, just because I think it's a principle, you know, that emerges from the basic foundations of how schools were determined coming out of the Northwest Ordinance and, you know, those kinds of things, that it's a community comes together to educate our kids. And over time, we've seen things like, well, shouldn't we have commons? There are things that we should have in common that make sense. But at the end of the day, I think there's part of the beauty of education is allowing different places to do things differently, and that's okay, and that's in fact makes our system even stronger and better than it would otherwise be.
The Ohio General, I guess it's Republicans, have introduced another bill that would eliminate 8 seats on the State Board of Education. It would eliminate the 8 Board of Education members appointed by the governor. House Bill 298 would cut Ohio State Education Board from 19 down to 11. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's funny because so many times the idea of governance comes up, you know, and what I tell people is, look, there's no magic in governance. I usually talk about it in terms of state superintendents. Some state superintendents are elected in some states. Mm-hmm. Some are appointed by governors. Some are appointed by school board members. But there's no research or no track record that would say that any one of those is any better. The minute you say, I'm going to bring a collection of people, whether they're elected, appointed, you know, drawn by lottery or whatever, you're still going to have, different ideas, different perspectives. And sometimes it'll be highly functional. Sometimes it won't be particularly functional. That's just the way it is. There's no magic in terms of configuration. So, I mean, I understand why people introduce this kind of legislation, but I actually think it doesn't really get, if there is a problem, what we ought to do is figure out what the real problem is and then try to think through what would address that particular problem.
Do you think there's a problem?
I actually don't. I think the way, you know, and I was around, you were too, when George Voinovich, was pushing for a different approach and ended up with this hybrid. I think it brings out a lot of interesting balance between those who are in fact elected and yet those who come with the imprimatur of the state's chief elected executive. When I look back and say, well, would it have worked better if it had been different? I can't quickly come to a conclusion and say yes.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, that's a really good point. People don't realize it's relatively new that the governor has many appointees. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest this hour is Paolo Di Maria. He is he retired in September after nearly 6 years as the state superintendent of public instruction. In January, he moves on to become the president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Ohio School Boards Association announced today that it is cutting ties with the National School Boards Association. Now, they cited frustration over a recent request for federal intervention at school board meetings. Now, I know this is not the group that you'll be leading in January. But it does reflect that member associations are willing to split from national groups over political positions. And I'm wondering if that's a worry for you. Do you see something becoming unraveled here?
Well, so and you're exactly right, because I am going to be taking a leadership role in a member services organization, right? I will have members that are the state boards of education, and the success of those kind of organizations are dependent on, you know, keeping those members happy. And I think the National School Boards Association ran into this issue, and really, I don't have any background about how they vetted their particular position or their choices. I'm mm-hmm. sure they have a board or something, but it seems like they misjudged the action that they were taking, and maybe, you know, went a little bit outside their lane. I always get that some of these jobs can be really challenging. You know, I've had my share, you know, in my 30 years of state service, of people that have been unhappy with me, who've yelled at me, who've berated me, and what have you. And in some ways, you kind of get that, hey, that's part of the deal when you venture into the public service and the public sector. I don't think it represents an unraveling. I think it's an isolated sort of organizational issue that I think the national is attempting to rectify, and the local board members are doing, you know, what they deem right is exercise their membership power.
Two things that we have shortages of these days: teachers, substitute teachers, and bus drivers.
Right.
And you know, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that, because it is a real problem in a lot of districts. What do you make of this?
Yeah. No, it's actually fascinating because we get all hyped up on all these other issues when the practical, like getting students to school, which is really important, is vexing us. My mother-in-law was a school bus driver for 30 years in the Birmingham Public Schools in Michigan. I often wonder, I always think that how do we access people who could see spending a few hours in the morning and a few hours in the afternoon? You know, how do you package the job of a school bus driver in a way that makes it attractive and yet, you know, flexible or appealing within the context of a broader sense of their careers and so forth and so on? I have no secret answers to any of this, but I'm optimistic that there are great minds out there thinking through them and trying to figure out what works. I also think to the future in terms of technology, it's going to be interesting to see 30 years from now if autonomous transportation approaches make sense in the education space.
Let's see. Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the bus drivers are interesting, but the substitute teacher issue is the one I am most interested in. I was a substitute teacher in 100 different buildings, for several thousand days, and was shocked that there was no advocate for the substitute teachers, local or state, and that they weren't allowed to organize themselves. And there was never a raise, though each district had their own rate, which varied a little bit over the 10 years I was doing it. I know recently there has been, but I have an idea, which you could advocate now that you're out of government, maybe, to bring back and encourage the people who were substitute teachers by giving them a bonus if they return, or just paying them what you should have paid them and giving everybody, a dollar an hour for every hour they worked the last 20 years and didn't get appreciated.
You know, I think it's really interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Sean, but the value and how we value or undervalue people like that. And it goes right to our, and this is, of course, is concern to any educator at any level, is what we do at, preschool levels and all of it, daycare, everything, how we undervalue those people.
You also think about adjunct professors at universities.
Yes, same
is in that
diff.
Same category.
Same
like
thing,
you're a utility player, right? In the grander team, and yet are you really valued for the service that you provide? Sean, you raise an excellent point. I think there are people out there looking at, they're looking at, teachers who are retiring and saying, well, could you still step up and be a substitute? There's the whole troops to teachers movement where retired military personnel, so there are, as our society is aging, there are more and more people. But the challenge is making it attractive to those people, both from a perspective of the compensation, but also from the perspective of working conditions and school climate and those kind of, and making it clear what the expectations are for their service. So, I tip my hat to in Franklin County, the Education Service Center of Central Ohio has sort of consolidated all the different districts in there, and they manage all the substitutes in a very collaborative way, which I think makes it easier for people to kind of enter into the substitute team teaching world. But again, the workforce in this country broadly is going through lots of, you know, economists are scratching their heads about what's going on and what's driving people's decision making. And I think that's amplified in these areas of substitute teachers, bus drivers, even substitute bus drivers is another area that's even more, you know, kind of dire.
Are you worried, though, that this is somehow going to have a long-term impact on kids who are constantly having substitute teachers because of the teaching shortage, that they're we talk about transience among students. What about transience among teachers?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, Ohio is blessed with a large number of institutions that educate teachers.
Yeah.
Some of my colleagues in other states that don't are already experiencing, you know, never mind substitute teacher shortages, they're having teacher shortages
right. Straight
out and having to, you know, adjust their standards. And it's almost like, you know, they'll take anybody that can show up and say, hey, I have this level of knowledge and work in a school. But I think I would agree with you that I'm worried about it. But I also see it as another element to helping us think about how do we really restructure the education experience in a way that either leverages more people's knowledge and skills who typically may not be teachers, but then also creates a more personalized educational experience for every student. And what does that actually look like?
And all of that while also still valuing and adequately compensating people to be teachers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tricky. Sean,
very tricky.
Thanks a lot for that call. The school funding formula has bedeviled me, happily will admit, for 30-odd years. I've sat through more committee hearings, you know, back in the day.
That's right.
Than I want to even remember. And sadly, I can literally remember sitting in these things and thinking, I have no idea what they're talking about right now because it's such gobbledygook. What are your thoughts and feelings about how school funding is working right now and what's ahead of us with this
new plan? I'm excited that the General Assembly and the budget, you know, adopted an approach phased in that was the result of, again, a collaborative effort bringing people together to really think through issues of fairness, issues of appropriateness, issues of, you know, coming up with the right, you know, with the right numbers. And so that's right now in its infancy in terms of implementation. And again, when I left the department, the team was really in full bore redesigning the systems, doing, you know, contracting for some of the cost studies and so forth and so on. So I'm excited, you know, and part of me is also desirous to move beyond the funding debate, right? Because everybody talks about money, 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 when we all also know that it's not just how much money, it's how you spend the money that's really important. And a lot for a lot of, you know, a lot of my career, I've been saying, you know, while we wait for the funding solution to come up, we really need to focus on the choices that we're making with the resources we already have. Again, in that spirit of being good stewards of taxpayers' dollars so that we're spending wisely and spending with impact.
And you know, I think one of the things I became most aware of back in those days during the school funding, you know, hearings in the 90s was how different districts have to spend money.
Right,
so if you're in Trimble Local Schools, you know, in Appalachia, transportation is a ridiculously large part of your budget. When you're in, you know, in an urban school in Toledo, Ohio, it's security and that kind of a thing is a ridiculously large portion of their budget.
Yeah.
How do you manifest your hopes and dreams for public education
and this really
in Ohio
speaks
when it's so different?
To your point about complexity, right? What I always told people is like the reason it's complicated is because it tries to address a lot of nuances in terms of the differences among and between districts. So you need to have a transportation formula that recognizes that district that's geographically dispersed versus the one that's geographically compact.
With crappy roads and all kinds of stuff that you don't even think about.
So every aspect where you see lots of variability then becomes, you know, even in special education funding, you have to differentiate between the different types of students, right? So that adds an element of complexity. And then you have, you know, gifted students, and that adds an element of complexity. And you're counting students differently, and then you're rolling things up and so forth and so on. So I think Ohio has always been recognized as being a state that that has done a pretty decent job of understanding those points of variability and trying to accommodate them in an appropriate manner so that you don't put anybody in the unusual position of, you know, I got to run this many buses and now, I just don't have I can't really run a school system without doing
it. Right. I would imagine in Montana, all the different districts there all have basically the same kinds of issues. They're not as diverse.
Yeah. Although you'd be surprised, even in Montana, I think you'll find, you know.
Am I doing a broad brushstroke on Montana there?
There
yes.
You go. There you go.
We're going to continue our conversation. My guest is Paolo Di Maria. He is the most recent state superintendent of public instruction in Ohio. He retired in September. In January, he becomes president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking this hour about the state of public education with Paolo Di Maria. He recently served as the state superintendent of public instruction. He held that position for nearly 6 years until his retirement in September. And he's going to move on and become the new president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education in January. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Department of Education completed and approved its strategic plan in 2018, and that was a major undertaking, and it took into account the whole child and how to make sure they're ready for learning and very personalized approach to it. What were the biggest challenges about that? Because you and I were just talking off the air, so sometimes I forget what we just talked about on air and what we talked about off air, right? But what about that personalized approach, and do we really have the resources to do that, or is it a state of mind?
Yeah. No, I think we do. I think we do, because I think increasingly that's what both students want and what parents want. Because, if you really want a student to be engaged in the learning experience, you have to make it relevant. You have to make it speak to their aspirations, their passions. And if they don't have any aspirations or passions, you have to help set it up so they can discover those. The thing about the strategic plan that I always wonder whether strategic plans have longevity, and I've been really pleased that the one we wrote actually became something that we used as an agency to really drive our activity, and then many districts and other associations kind of latched onto because we involved them. I mean, this was the and I tip my hat to Governor Taft, because Governor Taft's strategy in education policy was to bring people together. He had those task forces that really focused on things, and he knew that if you could bring people together and coalesce around a certain approach, that they'll join hand in hand to make sure implementation happens. So I think we're seeing that coming out of the strategic plan, and that's a really big plus.
One of your goals was to make learning fun, and I guess it seems sort of prosaic to say that. I mean, because it's so complicated now.
Right.
How is learning fun when teachers spend so much of their year getting ready to have their kids tested, the grades from which are used to judge the teacher?
Well, so again, the way you phrased it is sort of like, okay, that may be one approach, but it doesn't have to be that. You can still make learning and teaching joyful, even though your objective is to have students acquire knowledge and skills such that they're able to do well on a test, right? It doesn't have to be a drudgery. So if your approach is, okay, I'm teaching to the test all year so that they can do tests, of course, you're going to project that approach into your classroom experience. But if your approach is, I want to instill in my students a love for biology, right, then not only will they have that love for biology, but then they'll also learn, right? This is the thing that always confused me about the whole notion of teaching to the test. It's like, but if you teach the subject matter, they'll also do well on the test, right? You don't have to teach to the test. You can teach English or math or science or the thing that you love. The reason you became a teacher wasn't to teach for kids to succeed on a test. It was to teach this subject area that you're passionate about and to help nurture and grow a love for that subject with your students. So if I always say, if we do more of that, our students will be successful. and because they'll not only acquire the knowledge and skills, they'll enjoy the process of doing it, and they'll be that much more engaged.
Matt in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. I first wanted to just congratulate Paulo on his retirement. He's done a great job as state superintendent, and I wish him luck at NASB.
Thanks, Matt.
I had the privilege of working with Paulo when he was the head of school funding, and so we went through a lot of major policy issues together. One thing I was just curious about is I think the Doe case may have been resolved, the big special ed case.
Absolutely, yes.
Kind of wondering, where that all, how that all shook out.
What was it about?
So the Doe case was a longstanding case brought by advocates for students with disabilities about both the funding and the services that students with disabilities were receiving. And it had been on the books for like 20 plus years. And we eventually sat down with the interested parties and said, let's sort this through. What exactly do we want, and where do we want to land? A number of things came from that. We crafted a settlement agreement that called on the state and a certain number of districts to do some things that reexamine. And I think the way I always talk about it is focus on creating a better educational experience and better educational outcomes for students with disabilities. The other thing
as required by federal law.
Yeah. The other thing that we did was we convened a task force that did just tried to look at this issue across the state. And we issued a report called Each Child Means Each Child. And it really spoke to, going back to this notion of personalization, mm-hmm. is, you know, that if you and when you look at achievement gaps, the actual group that has the largest gap is students with disabilities. And except for the very tiny amount of students that have, cognitive, brain issues, they're all capable cognitively of mastering the subject material. So Each Child Means Each Child was our attempt to put forth a kind of a roadmap for how do we continue to push ourselves to make a better educational experience with better educational outcomes for students with disabilities. And some of it goes back to that notion of not creating these silos where special ed is someone else's, mm-hmm. Concern. And so that person has a separate relationship with the student in terms of whatever their needs are. And it kind of falls through the cracks of the broader educational experience. So I'm optimistic that coming off of that case, we'll continue to see more progress and greater academic experiences and outcomes for these students.
And this is physical, intellectual, emotional disabilities, special
ed students.
That's
exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Let's see. Catherine in Columbus, you're on the air with Paulo DiMaria. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. My question is in regards to the expenditures that schools as well as districts should be placing on IT, their IT for students, but also their IT for their network and software within the school itself. How much do schools be spending on IT? And then my other question is, do you see school districts hiring a chief information officer he or she will be examining the Internet of Things and all the information that's available through the digital economy?
Okay.
Those are great questions. Many districts already have CIOs, or in the smaller districts, we have these entities in Ohio called Information Technology Centers, which are meant to sort of be serving as CIOs or chief technology functions across multiple districts. But absolutely, you're so right. We see more and more expenditures on IT, especially during COVID. A lot of districts were buying hotspots. They were moving to one-to-one technology per student, and investing investing in their own infrastructure, because they were finding even when students were in their schools, they were, you know, taxing their infrastructure more heavily, because when everybody's on the computer and trying to access the internet, that creates its own bottlenecks. So, yes, you're absolutely seeing that. I don't think there's any rule of thumb about how much people should spend, but I think there are some standards that exist about the amount of bandwidth and the capacity of technology within buildings. And what's to me even more interesting is the use of technology in the education experience. And, you know, Anne, you and I go back, you know, back to the days of SchoolNet.
Right.
You know, when the state was, and I think I was at OBM at the
time. That was during Taft administration.
Yeah, we were deploying, you know, large amounts of technology into schools, wiring computer workstations and so forth and so on, you know, anticipating that there would be use. And I think what happened that COVID actually sort of was a mass kind of, you know, okay, we are now going to, you know, drop you into the deep end and see if
kind of the necessity is the mother of invention. Right.
I mean,
right?
I tell people like this tiny virus did more to expose teachers to how to use technology and mm-hmm. teaching and learning than anything else we've tried in the past.
And, you know, so there was SchoolNet. There was also the funding changes. We found that even when they built all the new brand new schools all over the state, that the districts couldn't afford
right.
to put the computers into them. I don't know how many buildings I went into that were the computer classes were empty because they couldn't afford the infrastructure.
Right. Although I think they ultimately changed the design manual in the School Facilities Commission to accommodate making sure that when you build a new building, it's wired, it's equipped, and so forth and so on.
But then I'm wondering long term what your thoughts and feelings are about a digital divide that already exists between rural and urban, and already exists between the haves and the have-nots in the urban areas. You're right. They did put up these, and it looks like they're going to stay. They're going to keep the hot spots and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But ultimately.
Well, and ultimately, these are really sticky issues. And I tip my hat to Governor DeWine and John Husted for really championing and investments by the state. And I think the federal government's also making some investments.
Of course, yeah.
And dealing with those dead spaces in the state in terms of internet access and so forth and so on. Because ultimately, that's what it's going to take, a rural electrification-like kind of effort to really bring internet, you know, to
except that so far they're pretty much relying on the market system at this point.
Well, I think it's going beyond that. I think you're beginning to see places where I was at a few public announcements where public-private partnerships are investing in certain infrastructure that's making internet accessible to more and more people.
But lawmakers have started to work on legislation to ban those kinds of collaborations.
Well, you know, I'm always a believer that these things will work themselves out and move forward because I think there is a shared understanding that in fact we can do better in terms of technology access, and we have it's within our capability and within our grasp, and I think good people will apply themselves to that end.
I was listening to an interview yesterday with Barack Obama and. Bruce Springsteen. Did you hear that? And he called it fighting optimism. You still have to work really hard at it, but you can also be optimistic about it.
Absolutely. And people who know me know that that's my disposition. I'm a hopeful, joyful, optimistic kind of person. And it's served me well, I think.
You are starting this new position as president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education.
Yes.
So this is the national association that our State Board of Education is a member of.
Actually, our state board is not a member of the association.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask you.
But many are, in fact.
Why isn't ours?
I don't really know that, but you know, maybe that'll change.
So there's only 50 states. How many members do you have, and what's your job going to be?
Well, basically, you know, the bottom line is supporting this, you know. And I've worked with, over 60 State Board of Education members in my term, both as state superintendent and previously as associate superintendent for school funding. And I'm a big believer in the important role that state boards of education play in the broader, you know, state policy context. Always respectful, because my first job was working for the legislature, that the legislature does get to set the parameters. And that is influenced by the governor and the governor's role in that process as well. But ultimately, state boards have to translate that into the workable policies and practices and then corral the State Department of Education to actually do the work that ultimately manifests itself in, you know, what the education experience and the outcomes are going to look like in that state. So our role is to support those groups to help them be the best they can be, to govern effectively, to lead effectively, to better understand issues, to understand data and the evidence for different things that they're wrestling with. We just had our annual conference here a couple weeks ago, and I love the discourse. I love the topics that were discussed, and I'm excited about the new staff I'll be working with and the things that we're going to be doing.
Challenges ahead. You got 30 seconds. What's the biggest challenge facing education?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is continuing to put ourselves on a trajectory of improving and making sure more and more students acquire the knowledge and skills that are going to be necessary for them to succeed in our workforce and succeed in their life. And I think we're doing some great work across the country in that area, but more to be done and more to be understood and scaled in a way that allows every student to succeed.
So basically, don't sit back on our haunches and never be satisfied. Always be working.
It goes right back to the strategic plan that was enacted. Each child, our future. We have to help each child be successful, and we haven't gotten there yet.
That's Paolo Di Maria. He was the latest state superintendent of public instruction. He retired in September. In January, he becomes president and CEO of the National Association of State Boards of Education. Paolo, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Ann. Keep up the great work you do.
Thank you. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks for the calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.